This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 184, where AC and I are going to talk about all the latest cloud news, recorded live March the 7th, 2017.
ShareGate makes it easier for organizations to adopt and use the latest Microsoft productivity tools, helping millions of users be happier and more productive at work. ShareGate is trusted by over 10,000 IT admins from over 110 countries to manage, migrate, and secure their SharePoint and Office 5 environments. ShareGate is recognized as the must-have tool for day-to-day administration of on-premises, cloud, and hybrid environments. Interested in learning more? Check us out at ShareGate.com to learn how ShareGate can make you more productive.
AC.
CJ.
How you doing, mate?
I'm doing okay. I'm a little overwhelmed, but I'm doing okay.
Hey, well, speaking of overwhelming, we've got some Office, AWS, Google, Docker, and some picks this week.
There's been a lot of stuff going on lately.
There actually has, and for our listeners, we are trying to get better about interleaving our news shows with our interview shows and other sort of topical type things. We hope that we don't get too far behind in what's going on in the news like we did, you know, sort of 3 or 4 months ago. And we can keep up a little bit better.
I'm almost starting to think that we need to like split off different shows or something, because I wonder if people would be interested in that. So we talk about Microsoft Cloud news, and then we also throw out some other stuff like dev, specifically around containers, which isn't really cloud, but it has a big crossover and a lot of interviews and stuff. So I wonder if our listeners would be interested in something like that.
Definitely tweet us or jump on our Facebook page and leave us a note, or tweet us, obviously, and let us know what you think. Also, I brought up an idea around doing a show around just like completely unfounded and zero evidence level rumors that, you know, we hear a lot of things from all sorts of different people, and some of them come true, some of them don't. But there's some interesting rumors kicking around, and I thought, hey, we should maybe do a rumor show at some point and talk about some of the, they're not news yet. Maybe that's what we should call the show. It's not news yet show.
Yeah. Does it mean stuff like, you know, rumors like cloud, like climate change and all that?
Exactly, yeah. No.
I am totally kidding. I am not at all. I'm not at all suggesting that I don't believe that something's going on.
Rumors with some sort of basis, but only because we've heard them from inside sources and so forth. But, you know, some of them come true, some of them don't. So we'll see. It's an idea.
It's a little dicey since we're both wrapped up in a couple NDAs. So it's like, all right, so what can I talk about that doesn't really fall under an NDA that I have heard about? But then there's other stuff that I've heard about that is wrapped in an NDA, but it might not come.
Exactly.
Yikes.
We've got to tread a pretty careful line. And we don't want to piss anybody off. Like, that's not the point, right? It's just to talk about interesting things. Well, come on. No. At least my goal, it's definitely not to piss people off, but it's more like, there are some good, juicy things going on, and they haven't transpired yet, but might be worth chatting about at some point. Anyway, tweet us what you think. Leave a message on our Facebook page or get in touch with us. The contact details are at the end of the show, and let us know what you think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, so what are you up to lately, man?
Oh, gosh. Taking the kids skiing a lot. It was our first...
Yeah, you have.
First proper season. They had a couple of lessons last year, but it was very much just like, get them used to being in the cold and in the snow and stuff like that. And then this year we've hit it pretty hard. We've been taking them up every weekend. They've had lessons in the morning, and then we've taken them skiing in the afternoons. And man, oh man, if there's one, like, I used to skydive quite a lot, and people thought that was terrifying. There's only one thing more terrifying than skydiving, and that's watching your kids ski. because it makes me so proud to see them absolutely gunning it, but also terrifying. All I see is like a bag of skin and bones flying down the hill, right? and they're getting really good, and it was super fun this year, and we've had a blast. So, that's what I've been up there this weekend, and probably taking them again, and they've been having a great time. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, I would love to do it. It's not very accessible for where I am, but...
A little bit further of a drive. Yeah. How about you? What have you been kicking around?
I've been going with the liquid water approach, where our kids are on a year-round swim team. Well, actually, they're on two swim teams, one for a summertime swim team, but then a year-round. And the year-round, we had a big swim meet, two-day swim meet this past weekend. It is, it's not terrifying like what you're dealing with. It's exhilarating. But I'm a race guy. I know you're a race guy. I love the speed. I love competition. And I have absolutely fallen in love with the sport, with the competition swimming, because while you are racing against other people, at the group that we're in or the age that we're in, it is all about really racing to acquire points for your team. And you're always just trying to do better than what you did last time. And so, I mean, I think my kids had individual events. I think that they had something around 10 events that they swam over this weekend. And I think each one of them, of the 10 events or 8 events, one of the two, probably 80% of them, they set PRs. I mean, my son set a PR on one from like a 2-minute race. He knocked 14 seconds off of it the last time he raced it. So it's just, it's
That's
fun.
Awesome.
Right, you know, cheering on his friends and hanging out with our different swim families that we're friends with in our neighborhood. It's a lot of fun. So that's that side. The other side that's been busy is I am finally getting very, very close to publishing the starter edition of my Mastering the SharePoint Framework course. This isn't going to be a lot of like, how do you build web parts? This is going to be more of introduction, dev tooling, and all that stuff. It's taken longer than I wanted to get it up and running, but I got bit a couple times on, you know, when they did releases and the APIs changed and I had to re-record stuff. I finally said, you know what? I'm not going to record anything until they go GA. So I planned a lot for it. I've recorded a bunch and now I'm kind of hitting my stride. So I'm getting new platform and everything. It's going to be interesting to when I go through and push this out for the first time. I'm a little hesitant trying to nail it. I really wanted to publish it this week, but probably by the time this episode comes out, I'm about a week away publishing at the about middle of March. We're going to go on vacation for a week next week, and I wanted to make sure that I didn't publish and then run out the door and have stuff, an issue pop up. But
yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
Hey, that actually leads us into a really good first topic.
Ha, ba-da.
Ta-da. So this is a news show. We're going to cover some news from Office, AWS, Google, Docker, and then we've got a couple of picks at the end. But one of our first news items, which you're probably far more qualified than I to talk about this, but we can both weigh in, is the new SharePoint framework has GA'd, which this your course that you're working on is all about this, right? So, or the first one is leading into this, at least anyway.
Yeah, Microsoft announced this. I got to give them credit. You know, they announced this back on May the 4th of last year, of 2016. They shipped a developer preview initially in the late summer, early fall of 2016. Went through, I think, 6 different dev preview drops. They did a release candidate. Strangely, it was release candidate 0. I think that we all thought that that was release candidate 0 because they needed room for potentially 10 release candidates and they didn't want to go into double digits. But apparently release candidate 0 means there's 0 more coming, because then they went straight to GA on, I think it was February the 23rd is when they went GA. So there's some interesting things about it. The week before they talked about some roadmap-y kind of stuff. I'm happy to see that they follow through with it. It's done. I'm interested to see where they go with it as well. It's definitely worth, you know, checking out for everybody that's in there now. But I'm interested to see where they're going with it. It is all NDA. They do these things called developer kitchens or dev kitchens where they bring a bunch of ISVs and people that are wrapped up in NDAs to kind of see where they're going and get feedback on where they're going, and stuff may never see the light of day. But at the end of March, I'm going to be flying out to Pacific Northwest and sitting in a room for 3 days. All day, probably all night, just doing a hackathon and a bunch of stuff. So I think
we get to hang out more than we have in a long time. Going to that too.
Are you going to go through all 3 days?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That'll be fun.
It's okay. I'm bringing somebody who can code too. So
that
should
good.
Be good.
Oh, so Jeremy's not coming.
Oh, the bird.
Love it, JT.
One of our devs, Ted, from my team is coming along and we're going to hack on some projects. So, but this is a good milestone for them, right? Like, as much as, you know, there are pros and cons that we've all got around this stuff, it is a big milestone for them. I know they've been working on this a long time. It was something that was in progress before I left Microsoft and hadn't seen any of the light of day at that point, obviously. But it's something the team have been working on for a long time. So full credit for them to, you know, getting it out the door. To GAing something at Microsoft is a really, really big deal. And a lot of work goes into these projects. And so it's great to see them. Great to see them deliver. Of course, I always want more, right? As we all do. And I've got my questions and concerns about it, but we will see where it goes next, right? They're getting, as they have always said, Rome wasn't built in a day. And yeah, I expect it to be built in less than a day, but you know, that's just expectations. I can do that now I'm on the outside. And it's the first stepping stone, I think. And it'll be interesting to see where they go. We should actually do an entire show about the SharePoint framework and talk about what it is, the new SharePoint framework, what it is, what it can do, what it can't do, who we think it's targeted at, kinds of things, that sort of stuff, and dive into a bunch more detail now that it's GA'd.
I think we should do that at the end of March when we're together. We sit down because we can do it together. We got a bunch of people who are going to be thinking about it at the same time. We maybe get some input from different people.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. So I think that people, I mean, there's definitely, like you said, concerns, questions, whatever. I think that when you distill it down, you know, the team said what they wanted to do. To me, the SharePoint framework, I did an interview recently with two guys in SharePoint podcasts that you can check out on my site, on my blog, if you want to listen to that. I think to me, the SharePoint framework very simply is one thing. It is a way to take the customizations we did with the content editor web part or the script editor web part, package them up and deploy them and ship them in a reliable way. Done, period, that's it. It doesn't do anything else. That's all it does. And it's primarily for enterprise developers, not for ISVs right now. I mean, ISVs could do it. You could build it. You could package it up and sell it. But you don't have a store model or anything like that. Where the team wants to go with it from there, let's see. I personally love the approach of embracing the client-side dev and giving people a way to go through and ship it. There's some implementation things that, of course, if I were king, I would do things differently, just like everybody else would as well. But credit to them. They said what they were going to do. They did it. They shipped it. Now let's see where else they go with it. So congratulations on them.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to seeing where they take it. I got a special spot in my heart for SharePoint still to this day, after having worked on it for many years. And so I'm keenly interested in seeing where they take this.
Cool. So what other office news do you have for us?
A couple of other small bits and pieces in office land. The first of which is Outlook 2016 for Mac adds support for Google Calendar and Contacts. That's kind of cool, like for Gmail users out there. If you're on a Mac and you want to use Outlook, which a lot of people do, it's still a pretty good mail client for Mac at least. I don't know about Windows these days. It's kind of ubiquitous on Windows, I guess. But being able to add support for Google Calendar and Contacts means you're not stuck with the out-of-the-box mail client from Apple, which, let's be frank, is a very good basic mail client but doesn't do a lot of the things. So, yeah, that's a little bit of tidbit of news. The other one is the OneNote REST API now supports application-level permissions. So I don't know if you're aware or if many of our listeners are aware, but OneNote has some cloud APIs to allow, you know, doing things like creating notes and stuff like that in a notebook. But one of the things that was lacking was app-level permissions, so app-only level stuff. And so OneNote have gone and added some additional capabilities around that to go and interact with your notebooks up in the cloud and go do things like, you know, create notebooks, provisioning different content, that sort of thing, getting it ready behind the scenes at app-only level kind of scenarios. So nice little improvements there on the OneNote API side of things. They've got some decent docs about the app-only permissions and what it lets you do up on MSDN.
Awesome. And we'll, of course, have a link to that in the show notes where people can take a look about.
Yeah, of course, it's all around the Azure AD auth model and all that sort of stuff. So it's in line and consistent with the other way you do things.
Awesome.
The Microsoft Cloud Show is sponsored by Valid.nl. Valid's motto is stay ahead. Its mission is to enable its customers to excel in their business through the innovative use of IT. Valid is always on the lookout for new colleagues. If you're interested in all things happening at Azure, whether in infrastructure, SQL Server, Office 365, Power BI, SharePoint, or .NET, look them up on valid.nl.
I am going to pivot away from Microsoft, and I'm going to talk about basically the day the internet died.
Wait, let me guess. S3.
It was S3, and strangely enough, it was on my birthday, too. I was actually in the middle of a podcast with two guys in SharePoint. I was in the middle of an interview, and I started getting texts from people like going, hey, your website's all screwed up. It's all funky. So, of course, I go over to the site while the host, Alistair, was speaking, and I look at it, and I see my site looks like complete garbage. And after a few minutes, jumping straight to the dev tools and looking at all the things that are happening, getting a bunch of errors, I'm like, it's all coming from one domain. It's a domain that I don't own. So, of course, you know, the stress level drops tremendously. And then you realize, oh, look, it's a CDN. Oh, that CDN is hosted by AWS. Let's go over to Twitter. Oh, look at that. Twitter's on fire now.
So the way I saw this is I saw something on Twitter and I was like, ooh, AWS issues, interesting. Let's go take a look at that. So I looked at the status page on AWS and it was all green. And I was like, what? That's all good. And then I was turning around joking with a guy at work. And we're like, huh, wouldn't it be interesting if they couldn't update the status page because AWS S3 was down?
Hey,
sure enough.
That's what happened.
That's what happened. So We were laughing, like, wouldn't it be funny if, like, the red emoticon or, you know, the flag or whatever was hosted on S3? That's why the red flags wouldn't render. pretty much that was it. But yeah, bad day for AWS.
This was really interesting. You know, I don't want to pick on AWS because I think that this could have happened at any of the different clouds. This could happen anywhere. When you see a big disaster, whether it's a plane crash or whether you see it's a company had a major issue or big catastrophes, it's generally a series of things that happens. And yep. It also is combined with the other aspect to it is it's a failure of an imagination or lack of imagination for something to happen. And so the technical side of what happened, first of all, AWS was unavailable. US East 2, I believe, region in Virginia was the one that got hit and effectively was offline. S3 couldn't do any HTTP gets or puts or deletes. Basically, nothing was working. And it was a really big deal because a lot of systems at AWS rely on S3 as their underpin. Just like at Azure, a lot of things rely on the Azure storage. And so a lot of companies also were affected by this outside of AWS. But what happened was a engineer was manually entering the steps in for a playbook. He fat-fingered something, or she fat-fingered something, probably a he. The men are the ones that make these kind of epic mistakes. And it basically took off a significant portion of their storage capacity all at one time. And AWS is designed to, you know, is built for failures and all that kind of stuff to be able to deal with those things to be able to respond to them, but it wasn't, you know, effectively set to, you know, you're going to lose a significant amount of capacity. When that happened, it also lost indexing. It also lost the ability to allocate additional storage. That went down as well. It took an hour or two for them to bring that back up. Once that back up, then they could bring back the allocation of storage and the indexing. Then they could do gets and then they could do puts. So it took a while to come back, but it was really interesting to see kind of, you know, not only their status page was based on their own service or hosted their own service so that when their service went down, they couldn't update their status page. And then a lot of their other stuff that was relied on, it was surprising that some of the stuff could happen. So I'm sure that, you know, not only have they gone through and they've made a bunch of changes, I would be absolutely floored if people over at Azure and Google Cloud Platform were looking at their own procedures and how they're set up to say, oh, hey, look. AWS even said in the postmortem that we'll put on a link on the show notes, that they said, you know, we hadn't tested this scenario before because this was just, it was such a big deal that we just hadn't tested for it. And I mean, even Netflix's Chaos Monkey, it didn't even account for it, or the Simian Army, they didn't even account for it. And Netflix went offline as well because of this, because they're hosted, strangely or ironically enough, they use Windows, but they use it on EC2 VMs and AWS.
That's right, yeah. Well, there's a couple of interesting things about this. One was, the dude fat-fingered, or somebody, I think it was a guy, anyway, he fat-fingered a command and took off like the capacity that you were talking about, inadvertently taking too much capacity all at once, so much so that it was, you know, not possible to keep the thing up. But what was really interesting was it basically resulted in them having to effectively reboot S3 in that data center. Mm. And one of the things that typically happens when you reboot a big-ass database, right, is there's a whole bunch of consistency checks that happen on things like indexes when they come back up. And apparently that's what took 3 hours alone, was like a consistency check or some sort of index check on the database or on the index that they use. And they'd never been through that in 6+ years. The last time they had to go do an index check or a consistency check on this thing was 6 years ago, because they just do not take that much capacity offline all at once. And so they'd never had this scenario. I thought that was really fascinating to watch. The other thing that I found was really interesting is notice the silence from Google and from Microsoft on this, right? And I think that is a very well thought out plan. Like, I bet there was a bunch of people that just wanted to sort of yell from the cliff tops about how awesome they are right now, especially in the Azure camp and the Google camp. But we all know people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones.
Yeah, I'm sure there were plenty of sales guys that are out in the field for Microsoft and Google that were just exploding it left and right. But the management inside of Redmond and inside of Silicon Valley where Google is, I'm sure they're all like going, everyone watch what's going on. Everyone review the policies and procedures and how we're set up. And don't say a thing at these guys because this could have happened. I don't know if it could have happened to us. I don't know how Azure and Google are architected to avoid something like this. But this was an epic This was an epic thing that a bunch of things just kind of that came together. So it was, it was annoying. Twitter was absolutely hilarious that day with all the memes that people were putting out. But it was these kinds of epic failures. They're fascinating to watch to see how they happen and then how they react.
Yeah. So it was an amazing amount of websites that no longer worked.
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
That was the tweet that was the Facebook post that I put up there. How do you know if a site's on S3? Is it working? No. Yes, it's working. It's not on S3.
That's right. I tweeted a picture of a DOS boot screen and I said, the internet be like, and then it was like, insert boot disk and press any key to continue.
I think my favorite one was the one with the guy from Pulp Fiction. He's a lot of other stuff.
Samuel Jackson?
No.
John Travolta.
Yeah, he's standing. He's got his suit on and he's got the coat on, and he's standing in the room with all the telephone cables like a switchboard, and they're all kind of hanging around. He's kind of looking around like, well, where's the problem? That was awesome. Yeah, so that happened. That happened on my birthday. It was rough, but it was...
Imagine being that dude and how bad you'd feel. Like, pretty bad.
I mean, that's one of those things. You make an epic mistake. And so, you know, you want to get out of there, but of course you have to stay to help it. But of course, you know, all your colleagues are like going, don't touch anything.
Yeah, that's
just
right.
Go stand over there. No computer for you.
It's not really his fault, to be honest. Like, whoever let somebody manually type a command that could potentially take down an entire data center, that's probably the problem.
That was on February the 28th. Guess what you couldn't do on March the 2nd at AWS?
What's that?
You couldn't take off that much capacity again.
Yeah,
you have to stage it.
Yeah, I think, yeah, for sure. Anyway, brutal day for AWS. It sounds terrible, really.
Yeah, it really was.
Terrible. Hey, on to cheerier notes.
Yeah, we got some fun stuff now.
Yeah, Docker have had some pretty interesting news. They announced a thing called Docker Enterprise Edition. This is kind of, I sort of feel like this is a bit of Docker growing up and maturing in many ways. So Docker came out with Docker Enterprise Edition, and they've renamed, I don't know what they used to call it, but now it's called Docker Community Edition, which is the free stuff, and Docker Enterprise Edition is the paid stuff. And so, you know, in many types of projects like this, you can use them for free, or you can pay and get better service and features and support and all that sort of stuff. And that kind of goes along with what Docker are doing with Enterprise Edition. Enterprise Edition is, you know, it's a commercially supportable version of Docker that customers can either run in Azure, AWS, or on-premises. And Docker will obviously do, you know, fixed support for it, service and support for it, things like that. And they've sort of streamlined their release process and versioning and all that sort of stuff that goes along with it. It's also going to be the engine that they use in products like Docker Cloud as well, which is kind of their online swarm and cluster management solution, I guess, for want of a better word, that we use quite a lot of, which is pretty sweet. Enterprise Edition comes in three versions, basic, standard, and advanced. And basic is basically just the basics, getting containers and stuff up and running on, you know, certified infrastructure with support from Docker. Standard adds image and container management, LDAP and AD user integration, and role-based access control for Docker Data Center. And advanced adds Docker security scanning and continuous vulnerability monitoring. So that's about, you know, being able to point it at images, container images, and make sure that they don't contain known vulnerabilities and various Docker layers and things like that. But Enterprise Edition is a paid product, and so it's going to cost you. But the Community Edition is obviously still free, and you'll still be able to use that as much as you like.
But it's a paid thing, but I think that it's also a really good thing for the industry. While a lot of people, I'm sure, will be a little frustrated with the fact that, hey, there's now a commercial thing that I have to pay for, which I know you don't have to. You can do the community one and you go basically, which means you're going to run it and support it on your own. But I'm sure there are plenty of businesses out there, plenty of enterprises and Fortune 500s that they simply won't buy something or they won't use something in their stack unless they have a support contract that they can back it with and they can pick up the phone and call somebody for help with expertise. So
exactly.
I think it's a great thing for Docker and containers as far as the technology goes and the business to have someone, the people behind Docker, be standing behind it to be able to help you. But also it's great for Docker because it also, I mean, that's a revenue stream for them. You know, it's funny because you see all the stuff with all the stuff that they've been doing with Docker recently. And I know I've shared one of these links with you and he did another one recently. I think his blog is the HFT guy, the high frequency trading guy. And he's where he looked at he does a bunch of serious compute stuff, and they were looking at using Docker and a couple different things for using Docker in production for some really, really sensitive and high demanding workloads. And I know he did an update to his blog post, his review and stuff, and they basically decided that Docker was not for prime time. It was a bad technology and all this stuff. I read his stuff and I'm like, yeah, it's funny you say that, because there's some people that are on the opposite side of that. And some of the assumptions that he was making about, I know he was complaining about, oh, you lose volumes in storage, so putting data inside containers, like, well, yeah, you're not supposed to do that. They're like, it's like, you don't store data inside your VMs. You want to get that off onto like cloud storage or more resilient storage instead of having it inside of some sort of a layer that you may not be able to get access to.
Mm.
But it was really cool to see them do this. And it'd be cool to see the news that comes out of DockerCon. I guess that's coming up in the next month or two or three out of Austin, Texas, coming up soon.
Yeah, that's going to be really interesting to see. I guess they're going to talk a lot about this then, and we'll learn more. But as far as Azure goes in particular, this is going to be the version of Docker that when you spin up a swarm in Azure using Docker for Azure, I think it's called now, you'll get this. So this will be what's provisioned.
Mm, very cool.
But like I said, it's paid, right? So you've got to go, it starts at, well, free for community edition, obviously, $750 for basic, $1,500 for, what do they call it, standard, and $2,000 a year. Sorry, that's per year for enterprise edition. So I'm guessing that's per node, right? Probably I think it's per node or possibly per swarm. I don't know. It doesn't actually say on their pricing page. Mm. It's kind of confusing.
So those are annual prices that you just quoted.
Yeah, exactly. Annual. So basic is $75 a month, $150 a month, or $200 per month if you want to pay per month, obviously.
Gotcha. Cool.
Yeah. So that's kind of, I guess Docker growing up, for want of a better word, right?
Mm, yeah, definitely.
Mm. We also have some more Docker news from Docker Cloud. So Docker Cloud, like I mentioned, is their online service for managing Docker clusters, whether they be in AWS or Azure or on your own hardware somewhere. We use it a lot for our orchestration and management of our Docker installations, and we run production and stage and development environments using it. It's really cool. They've now updated their cloud service with Swarm, so you can provision new swarms straight with AWS or Azure using Docker for AWS or Docker for Azure directly from Docker Cloud, which is really, really cool. And you can provision new swarms in those environments. And then when they're hooked up into Docker Cloud, you can obviously provision things to those swarms. But also what they're adding is what they're calling fleet management. So this is the ability with your Docker ID to manage a number of swarms wherever they happen to live, whether that be in AWS, Azure, or on your own stuff, and connecting them in. And they've even gone so far as adding swarm management into the Windows and OS X or Mac OS Docker applications. So you can connect your local Docker agent to one of those swarms running in AWS or Azure or somewhere else on your local box and develop against those as if they were, the Docker machines were running on your local box, which is pretty sweet. So this means you could go provision a swarm off in Azure, have it running up there, and on your local Mac OS box, connect to that swarm and start managing it and start using, Docker commands on the command line, like Docker info or Docker PS to get the containers running, all that sort of stuff, just like it was running on your own box.
That's really cool. That's very cool.
That's surprisingly complicated to get working from what I hear, and pretty awesome.
Pretty awesome they got this done. Yeah, there's a lot of big updates. This will be, I guess I just looked a little bit farther in. Looks like we're about a month away from DockerCon, April 17th through the 20th. So we'll have to have some special coverage on that show, on that conference that's coming up.
Yes, that sounds really good. We should definitely cover that. Be interesting.
Yeah,
love to. So that's it for Docker.
Awesome. I have
what do you got?
I have two bits of Google news that are. I'm going to do the more software side first, and then the IaaS side. These are coming straight from the Google Cloud Platform. That will keep these kind of quick. So the first one is a new product from Google Cloud Platform GCP called Cloud Spanner. So no, it's not what you think.
Spanner is a euphemism for a stupid person in New Zealand.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, you say like, oh, you're a complete spanner, means like you're a bit of an idiot.
I thought you were referencing like the AWS thing.
Oh, right. No. AWS could have done with a couple of cloud spanners the other day.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so Cloud Spanner, This is a really bad name because they do a really good job for all the names of all their other products, it seems, except for this one, because now I really can't, you can't tell what it is. Mm. This is essentially, this is their relational database cloud solution. So in the past, they have generally only had table-based storage option, a NoSQL-based storage. And now what they have, they wrote a research paper they wrote back in 2012 where they kind of explained how the whole thing would work. And then they put this together, and now they have their globally distributed relational database service that lets customers have their cake and eat it too. So you get ACID transactions, SQL semantics, all without giving up the horizontal scaling and high availability. One of the things that I find really interesting about this model compared to what Azure offers with their SQL Server, Azure SQL Server, and what AWS does with their relational offering is that you don't pay for capacity. You pay for consumption. So, and like with like Azure, with SQL, you're going to build more on like having, you know, you have to build like almost the size of the database that which you're looking to get, not just the compute power. With this, you only end up paying based on what you end up using. You do pay also based on what your, you know, how much power you want, so how heavy load your database has, so you can have it perform faster, but you don't end up, you don't have to pre-allocate space and stuff like that, which you kind of get limited on some of the stuff with SQL Server and Azure. It's you get, you know, a certain size database for these features and then this size database with these features, different payment model. So Google just seems to, you know, kind of leveling up and saying now, you know, we have a relational database offering as well.
Interesting. So this is kind of a compete with Azure SQL in Azure and Amazon RDS, is it?
Their RDS is actually, RDS, yeah. That's kind of a, their RDS is like a, is multiple things. Like you can do Oracle, you can do SQL, you can do Postgres, you can do a bunch of different things with Amazon RDS. It's kind of like Amazon storage. What kind of storage you want? Well, a queue, a table, a blob.
Gotcha. I see. Still, that's really cool. Nice advance from Google there. And they're doing some pretty good stuff. So it'd be interesting to see if somebody comes out with performance metrics and things for this and see what it can do.
I don't know. I love what Azure's doing. I love what GCP is doing. I get AWS is the big dog on the corner, and you know, in terms of like the public clouds. But I think it's more interesting watching what Google and Azure are doing with their clouds. Google's got a very different, feels like a more scientific approach to their stuff, like in terms of the customers they go for. But
yeah.
I don't know. It's interesting.
It seems more computer science-y.
That's where I'm kind of going with that. It seems more.
I know that's a dumb way to describe it, but kind of feels.
It is. I mean, and they don't have as much, they don't have as broad of an offering as what Azure and AWS have, but Google seems to go much, much deeper, and the offerings that they have are like super powerful and advanced.
Yeah, gotcha.
So here's another one that they have. Their Google Compute Engine, their IaaS offering, they have a beta that they've launched now with for different VMs that now can use the NVIDIA Tesla K8 GPUs.
K80.
K80s.
Right?
Sorry, thank you.
K80.
K80, mm-hmm. That's a big deal. That's a big difference.
Yeah, it's a factor of 10.
Just a bit.
That's 10 times better.
So these guys, each of these different GPUs has 2,496 stream processors with 12 gigs of GDDR5 memory. You can shape your instances for optimal performance, flexibility by attaching one, two, four, or eight GPUs to custom virtual machine shapes.
Good grief.
Yeah, that is massive. So these guys, their on-demand hour pricing comes out to 7 cents per hour, it looks like, in the US. In Europe, it's 77 cents. Sorry, 70 cents. 70 cents. 70 cents in the US, 77 cents in Europe and in Asia. Really, there's a big step up to all the machine learning, Google Cloud machine learning. These GPUs are tightly integrated with Google Cloud machine learning and also being able to take advantage of things like TensorFlow, which is their machine learning framework, which love to find somebody to get on the show to talk about that with us a little bit. That one, and talk a little bit more about the cognitive services stuff that Azure has to offer as well.
Mm, for sure. That's really interesting. I really want an excuse to use these, but I just don't know yet what I would do with them.
I got a friend that actually does do this stuff. He does a bunch of deep learning, machine learning with computer vision and stuff. And he's been doing it on EC2. And when this news came out, he was interested to take a look at it for on the GCP for stuff. He just ran a big Kickstarter for a new project he's working on that was really successful. So
yeah, gotcha. It's interesting watching. This is kind of the cloud war fronts right now, right? Between Azure, AWS, and Google about who can provide the fastest compute for machine learning and things. And it was on pricing last year, and it's kind of on storage, and bits and pieces have gone back and forth a bunch. And now it seems to be all around GPUs and perf and throughput.
GPUs, FPGAs, throughput,
yeah, exactly.
And AI libraries and capabilities.
12 gigs of GDDR5 memory. It's going to run Minecraft really well.
Oh, man, it's going to scream those big blocks.
Exactly. Nice.
So that's awesome. That's my news for around Google stuff for this
week. Very cool. Hey, picks. What do you got for us this week?
They're two techie ones. But one of them actually dovetails very nicely into one of the things we talked about earlier about AWS. There is an article, I thought you might be interested in this based on what your goals were this year. A company called Spire Labs, they are using Kubernetes for their entire stack. They are hosted on EC2, which is all the data storage for EC2 is on S3.
Gotcha.
Tuesday, February the 28th is the day that AWS died. Sorry, AWS S3 on the East US when that died. And they went out and the CEO or the CTO blogged about his experience the day after of the whole thing and said, you won't believe this, but thanks to availability sets and Kubernetes, we didn't believe the fact that we were watching everything going, you know, completely catching on fire. And we knew that all of our stuff was hosted in the same data center where S3 was having the problem, but we never saw a problem. And that's because they also had availability set up to where they had some capacity on the West Coast, and Kubernetes immediately detected the problems and started spinning up pods and transferring traffic from East US over to West US. And when they start, they didn't believe any of their dashboards, and they started going and looking at it. When they first started noticing the problems and they finally went into the Kubernetes dashboard or whatever the equivalent is to be able to see where all their pods are running, they could see S3 had been working for, I think, like 20 or 30 minutes, had been working on already going through and redistributing their workloads away from the data center that was having the problems. It was still in the middle of doing it, but I mean, they even went in and started trying to log into the machines and everything, because it looked like, even though the service, their applications were running just fine and Kubernetes, everything was just fine, they almost didn't believe it.
That's really cool. I'll definitely have to read that. That's fascinating.
Yeah, it worked exactly the way it's supposed to. It just redistributed things around. They didn't miss a beat or anything.
Well, it's amazing how many sites went down, right? And how many people don't have multi-data center redundancy. So yeah, that'll be a really interesting article to read.
Well, until the last few years, I think it was really hard to implement that stuff. So having this makes a big deal.
Yeah, real big difference.
The other one I'll throw in there, a really quick link, and I'll throw, this could turn into a huge discussion here, but
it's a blog post
here about a guy that said, why I left Mac for Windows. And he kind of ranted on and on about, you know, why he likes Windows more than Mac now. He was a Windows guy. He switched over to Mac back in 2013. Funny, about the same time I did with my laptop. And now has gone back. So
only at home though, right? Not at work. He's still a Mac guy at work.
Yeah. I would love to kind of go just have this discussion, go back and forth, because you and I have talked about this a lot offline, off the show. And
yeah,
so it'd be fun to kind of go off and do a little geek out on talking about Mac and Windows.
The main thrust of this article was how you can survive as a node developer now on Windows with the Linux subsystem and the tools and things that are available and how far it's come along since days of Windows 8 and stuff like that. So I thought it was a pretty good article. He focused quite a lot on that dev side of things, which, your mileage may vary and it might not be applicable to you. But yeah, I thought it was good. It was a good summary of things.
Yeah, definitely good. Yeah. That Unix subsystem thing was the big piece for him. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm definitely going to try it out more. I got a Windows machine on my desk at work and a Mac, so I switch back and forth a bunch every day. I got to try some of those things out of Windows. I may be tempted. I got a couple of picks.
Go for it.
The first one is for the man who has absolutely everything and you have no idea what to get him. And I say man because only a man would be this dumb. It is called an ice ball maker, and it is a $499 US block of aluminium, I think, or aluminum, for those in the US, and it makes 2.75-inch ice balls by basically pressing a square block of ice, and it pumps out a perfectly spherical block of ice. Now, if you're like me, you like your ice, and it is a bizarre obsession that I've got for no reason whatsoever other than I find it fascinating.
I completely agree with you on this statement.
I have absolutely no need for this and absolutely no desire to spend $500 on something, but I am strangely fascinated by how this would work. So if you've got one and you want to let me borrow it, get in touch because I'm not going to spend $500. But anyway, it blows my mind that you can, this is the way real bars make their ice balls, right? Or they hand chip them like, and, you know, sort of origami style.
Mm.
Like it takes a long time and it's hard work and it's crazy. But anyway, and the idea is that they melt slower than cubes and all that sort of stuff. Plus they just look, I think, ridiculously cool. I know that you're like, just get me straight to the booze.
No.
And without all of the ice preparation, but I've been fascinated by the whole clear ice thing. And now I want to make a clear ice and perfectly spherical ball. Yeah. Anyway, so that's my first pick. You're being very good about not mocking me to death, AC, which I applaud, but...
I think it's interesting and funny. I'm not going to make fun of you. Teach their own thing. People think I'm crazy for keeping fish and fish tank and everything, but I can appreciate it. It's not for me. That's all I'd say.
Yeah, fair enough. The second thing I've got is a video about what happens when you boil a bottle of regular Coke versus when you boil a bottle of Coke Zero. And it's got the side-by-side video of what happens when you're in a fry pan. If you tip a 1 liter, I think, or maybe it's a 0.75 liter bottle of Coke into a fry pan and boil it. And what basically is left behind, and it is mind-blowing. When you boil a regular bottle of Coke, let's just say that all the sugar is left behind and it forms this big syrupy molassesy-like paste.
Wow.
That's left in the fry pan. And when you boil a bottle of Coke Zero, almost nothing is left, like a little bit of coloring or some sort of residue, but a tiny, tiny little amount. It boils away to nothing. I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it did blow my mind that all of that sugar is going into your body. First up, it really helps you visualize how much sugar is in a bottle of Coke. And then the second thing, I'm not sure that a drink that boils away to nothing is good for you either. I just found it interesting, the difference between the two.
But the more it boils away to nothing, the closer it is to water, which has got to be healthier, right?
That's my logic. I don't know. I used to be a big Coke drinker, and I used to swear by drinking full, I call it fully leaded Coke, right? Mm. Which has got, you know, cane sugar, which is
Mexican
hard
Coke.
To get Coke made of, Mexican Coke, yes. In the US, we call it Mexican Coke because it's made of cane sugar, but it's basically rest of the world Coke, if we're being completely honest. The US uses high fructose corn syrup, and I don't know if that would boil down to the same stuff or not. I don't know. Anyway, I used to drink that stuff, and now I try to stay away from it entirely. But every now and again, I have a Coke Zero, and I've kind of grown to be okay with it. But I don't know. I'll probably die of some like horrific, slow, painful death because of it, but who knows. Anyway, I just thought it was a really interesting video to watch, and it blew my mind how much of this stuff goes into your body.
Yeah.
So it's interesting video.
That's interesting. I used to drink Cokes. I drink a Coke every single day for lunch and every time I had dinner, like when we were out or something. And then a couple of years ago, for some reason, I just decided to go cold turkey on soft drinks. About a year ago, I had my first full like soft drink in about 12 months. And got a massive headache from it, from the sugar.
Yep.
And that shocked me. So, I mean, not saying...
Strangely enough, I don't get headaches from real sugar Coke. I only get them from high fructose corn syrup Coke. So I don't drink that anymore.
It was a Canada Dry ginger ale, and they just nailed my... I got a bad headache from it. But I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. You know, just it didn't work for me.
Yeah, fair enough. Hey, good show, buddy.
I think so.
Caught up on a bunch of news, office news, AWS news, Google news, Docker news, some useless picks from me and some more interesting picks from you. So I hope everybody's enjoyed this show, enjoyed catching up on some of the news about what's been going on recently, and really enjoy, I think we've got an interview show coming up next week, right?
We do. We're sitting down with Richard DeZerga talking about the bot framework and Microsoft Teams, and we know that because we just recorded the intro for it, because I'll see you in 2 weeks. I'm going to Mexico in a few days for a week.
Yeah, that sounds really, really fun. Which part of Mexico are you going to?
Cabo San Lucas.
Very nice. Very, well, enjoy it.
Very tip of the Yucatan.
Come back recharged and ready to go.
Absolutely, we will. We are looking forward to it, putting our feet up and doing absolutely nothing for a week.
Perfect, perfect. Well, send me photos. It sounds wonderful.
I will when I get back.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Disconnect. Nice work.
Cool.
All right, AC. Have a great one.
You too, CJ.
Cheers.
Did you like this episode? Please tweet about it and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show, and we'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as a WAV or MP3 and provide us a link so we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is an excerpt from Evaporated Eric by Monk Turner, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and the Google Play Store by searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find show notes for each episode. You can also find us on Facebook searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up to our mailing list by heading to our website and entering your email to interact with us. Participate in upcoming interviews and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.